Welcome to the Game Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Welcome to the Game Mystery Podcast. My guest today is David C. Dawson, who writes the Dellingpole Mysteries. But before we begin, as always, we start the show with Justine and her reviews. Hello, Justine.
Hi, how are you? Surviving the quarantine?
I'm bored to tears, even though I'm always home. The fact that I am stuck here by law makes it different, and I'm going stir crazy.
Yeah. It's just the beginning. We're here. We're shut down to mid-April here in California, where we both live.
I just keep looking for things to do. Hey, I'm getting some writing done. That's the good part.
That's excellent. Well, I usually work from home, so my work is continuing unabated. All right, here we go. Today's book is, there are two books. David S. Peterson writes the Detective Heath Barrington series. His most recent book is Death Takes a Bow, which came out in 2019 and is currently a finalist for the Lambda Literary Awards. And the third book in the series, Death Checks In, was a finalist in the 2019 Lambda Awards. So he's attained some stature, and I picked these books up. And I think that's well deserved. They're very
2 years in a row isn't shabby.
Nope. 2 years in a row and two books in a row is not shabby. I picked them up. These are very Agatha Christie style mysteries. The Detective Heath Barrington is a detective in Milwaukee, and then his secret lover is Alan Keyes, who is a policeman in the same department. And whenever they're together, somehow a crime pops up, even when they're on vacation, and they work on, Barrington solves it along with Alan's help. Barrington refers to Alan as his partner, but it's really more of an uneven Holmes-Watson-style relation. Like Agatha Christie, these novels are chock full of suspects, chock full of clues, and the death comes halfway through. So here you have a slate of characters, a slate of little things that he notices about them, some of which may be important, some of which aren't. At the end, he explains Detective Barrington pulls all the suspects together in a room and explains the crime and talks about how the clues fit together and which clues distracted him and why. So it's a classic mystery. In the fourth book, Death Takes a Bow, he has a couple of shout-outs to Agatha Christie. They are set in 1947, and they are chock-full of historical flavor. In one of the books, they're at a party at somebody's house, and they open up a cabinet, and they see a brand-new television, which in 1947 was one of the very first televisions. And somebody comments that it's not going to last. And that doesn't end up being, that's one of those things you say, is that going to be a clue? No, that's a historical sidebar. And the books are also chock full of those. So they're very interesting.
I like the idea of a murder being in the middle, because I like it when you can get to know the character. Then you care when they die.
Yes. And there's sometimes a little guessing at the beginning, who are these people going to die? Because not all of them are particularly likable. But as you get closer, you say, oh, yeah, that's the one that's going to die. But then you don't know who's going to kill them or how. So it gets an intriguing recommendation. These books can be read as standalones. The relationship between Heath and Alan moves forward, but it doesn't move forward enough that you don't have to read them in order. I picked up book four and found it quite complete in of itself. And after that, I picked up book three, and I had, there were no spoilers for book three.
Well, that's good. That's always important. You know how important that is to me.
That's why I tell you. Agatha Christie books, you always pick those up, and you pick any one up in any order, and you can read it without having read the others.
And well, this,
is like that.
You said these are like Agatha Christie, but I don't remember her having a secret lover.
Well, you know, that's why this is called the Gay Mystery Podcast.
Agatha,
you never know what her curl Perot. You never know what he got up to in his spare time.
David, no,
just
you never know.
Onto the page a little more.
There you go. So we got an intriguing recommendation for both books.
Yes.
Any news from Requeer Tales?
Requeer Tales is about to launch the fourth book in the Grant Michael series, Mask for a Diva. And we've also recently released the entire Jazz Anderson series. The third book came out in the past few weeks. And last week we released Mountain Climbing by Stan Leventhal, which is a classic but not a mystery. By the way, all of our murder mystery series are available on Kindle Unlimited.
You guys have been busy. You were also going to make a comment about how to get David Peterson's books.
Oh, yeah. You know, I bought them on boldstrokebooks.com, B-O-L-D, strokes, S-T-R-O-K-E-S, books.com. That's the publisher. And their interface is quite good. You can buy a book. Often they have deals on their site. And you can get them cheaper for Amazon. And their download experience works very well. It's not a one click here. What's been delivered, it's more of a two clicks, buy it in the cart and download it. But other than that, it works very well.
There are options other than the big guy that we won't mention.
That's right. Go and support those independent publishers. And, you know, maybe they get a little more from your purchase than if you do it through some of the big box stores.
Anything else this week?
That's good. Looking forward to your interview.
Sit back and relax and enjoy. Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Game Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook. Links are on our website, GameMysteryPodcast.com. David C. Dawson writes contemporary thrillers. He's an award-winning author, journalist, and documentary maker. His latest book is Heroes in Love, published in January 2020. His debut novel, The Necessary Deaths, won bronze for Best Mystery and Suspense in the FAPA Awards. The second in the series is The Deadly Lies. His third book, For the Love of Luke, came out in October 2018. David lives in London with his boyfriend and two cats. In his spare time, he tours Europe and sings with the London Gay Men's Chorus. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you so much, Brad. It's good to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you on. Now, you've written both romantic novels and you've written thriller novels. What is it that attracts you toward thrillers?
Well, I started with thrillers, mystery and suspense, or thrillers. So the first book I wrote, Necessary Deaths, was for my own entertainment, really. I came out rather late in life. I was in my early 50s when I came out, and I'd been married before, and I have a son. Through that marriage. And I'd been writing for myself and short stories and so on. And when I came out, it kind of was like a dam bursting. And I was writing more and more. And then I thought one day, actually, I'd like to write a book, but I didn't know what. And I've always been a big fan of mystery stories or thrillers. And I actually have a mathematics degree. From many years ago. I didn't actually use it much in my working life, but I've got quite an analytical mind, I suppose. And so what I did was to pick some of my best or favorite authors and actually analyze their books and, you know, how many chapters make a book, how many words are there in a chapter, when does the protagonist come in, and when is there a crisis point and when is there a resolution. And then I wrote that down as the formula and wrote a book. A little more complicated than that, but roughly that's what happened.
So you took your short story and you learned the mechanics of creating a novel, the mechanical side of it.
Yes, I did. But actually the first draft of The Necessary Deaths was exactly that, just mechanical. And I went on a week-long writer's course in the north of England in Yorkshire. and had really nice tutors on that course who picked it up and said, yep, and ripped it apart. And at that point, I came back from the course and shoved it in the drawer of the desk. And it was actually my son who said, oh, what are you doing? You've just been on a course for a week. Why aren't you going to do something about it? So I did pick up the book and wrote the second draft and actually then gave it much more characterization and relationships. And then that became the leading to the final draft. But writing a romance, I was really terrified of. And it wasn't until I finished For the Love of Luke, which in the title it's For the Love of Luke, but there's still a thriller element to it. It's much more about a relationship. But there's kind of jeopardy, a lot of jeopardy in it, in fact. And my publisher said, this is great. Could you write a romance? And I thought, well, you never say no, which is a very foolish thing, I know, but it's always the way. And so I said, yeah, sure. And then I was terrified, I have to say. I was thinking, my gosh, this is all about relationships and emotions and people. But, and that's where Heroes in Love came from. And as a result of writing that, I'm now at the present moment finishing off the third installment of the Delingpole Mysteries. And I think I'm coming back to it with a much better brain. I think I'm coming back to it with a much better developed sense of characters and relationships and emotions. And that a thriller which is devoid of those is not quite as human as it ought to be. So I'm pretty confident that this next one, which is called The Foreign Affair, is going to be much more about how people manage to ride out a thriller, how people manage to survive in a mystery.
The answer to one of the questions I was going to ask is if there's going to be a third Delingpole mystery. In the mystery, British lawyer Dominic Delingpole, and then his partner is Jonathan McFadden. Mm-hmm. They're the protagonist in the thriller. And then, am I correct? Do you consider them thrillers, mysteries, or is there kind of a blur?
Yes. I like blurs, I suppose. But they are mysteries. But what's happened is that the plot lines I tend to come up with are usually international conspiracies. Based in the UK, but I wanted there to be something which readers from outside the UK could latch onto each time. And so inevitably, it seems I end up with some kind of international conspiracy. When I was growing up, I was a massive fan of Michael Caine films, the Ypres File and Funeral in Berlin and so on. And those have always stuck with me. And I always seem to end up, when I'm plotting something which becomes something about some deep, dark, bad organization somewhere. I suppose it's a bit of the James Bond as well. And so they've ended up as thrillers, but they started off as mysteries. And there's a blurred line there. What's the difference? That's an interesting thought. Because you asked me, are they mysteries or thrillers? I suppose the thriller keeps you on the edge of your seat, which is what I'm trying to do. I've always loved the idea of there being a cliffhanger at the end of a chapter. So people have to move on to the next chapter to get the what happens next. And in a mystery, I always think of mystery as Scooby-Doo for some reason. And, you know, they pull the mask off the bad guy in the end, and you find that there's a janitor from wherever.
You pesky kids.
Absolutely. If it wasn't for you. I loved tea time, coming home from school, tea time, sitting watching a Scooby-Doo on the television. Yeah, it used to be on a Wednesday, I remember, here in the UK.
Well, what do you consider makes a good gay crime novel?
Well, that's changed in my mind, actually. And I guess it also slightly changes depending on what day you ask me as well. But When I first started out, as I said, I decided I wanted to write a mystery. And it was because they seemed to have a formula. There seemed to be a process that you could go through, because I analyzed these books. And at that point, romances were complete mysteries to me, pun intended, I suppose. And I wanted to write, more than anything, a thriller or mystery or a thriller which had gay characters at the heart of them, and gay characters being the good guys and being people that I could relate to, and then hopefully the readers could relate to as well. And that's where Dominic Delingpole came from. He's a mild-mannered Englishman practicing as a lawyer in a quiet countryside town, and then thrust into this international conspiracy by accident. And so originally my idea was that you should have these gay characters, and also, as a result, be quite overt about their lives and what it was, what their relationships were like, and the jeopardy was part of those relationships as well. But interestingly, in writing the third one, in which I'm now focusing much more on Dominic's son, because we discover in the second book, The Deadly Lies, that Dominic had a son from a brief relationship with a woman many years before. And I'm now exploring that relationship, and between father and son, and also son who is himself gay. And so there again, I'm picking up on those relationships, but which comes from the fact that I've written a romance before. But at the moment, I'm reading James Patterson. I'm reading Killer Instinct. I don't know if you've read that one, Brad.
No, I have not.
It's really good. I mean, my gosh, what a writer. But interestingly, I mean, the central character in that is a gay character. But it's kind of incidental almost. It's just the fact that he's got a partner and they've had a young daughter through a surrogate. But the thriller is topmost all the way through. And I'm still not sure, I suppose, is the answer, is what readers want. And I get mixed. I ask people in my newsletter, you know, what is it you would prefer? What's the most important thing? And much of the time, the answer comes back, well, both. And so I, for the moment, I'm kind of trying to make sure there's a good balance between understanding what is a gay relationship. And as we know, there, for every gay couple, that's a different type of relationship, just as the same way in a straight relationship, and for every straight couple, there's a different relationship. Mm-hmm. But what I wanted to get across was how that often differs between a straight relationship and a gay relationship. And I wanted to get those ideas out there at the same time as keeping the readers fascinated with this plot or the mystery that's going on. Because in book two, in The Deadly Lies, I wanted to explore that whole area of open relationships, which is, as we know, much more common in gay relationships, but and is, I think, quite often frowned upon by others. And I wanted to open that up and say, come on, let's look at how successful this can actually be and how successful people have made this over the years. So it's a bit fluid, I guess, is the short answer.
Well, that certainly adds another layer to it, a little more complication and I would guess a little more of the emotions to it as well.
Yeah, and I guess it's the kind of emotions that other authors wouldn't have, but I feel very strongly about it. I'm still banging a drum for equal rights, so to make sure that our voices are heard. But I want to do it in a way which is not too in your face, that at the same time there is a plot line that can be read by straight readers quite happily. But maybe just make them pause to think occasionally about some of these issues, which, you know, we get bad press for very often, but I'd like to be able to put the opposite side there.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, when my novel came out, a family member said, I really enjoyed your book. I look forward to someday when you write a mainstream novel. And I said, well, what do you mean? This is my mainstream.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely right. It was funny. Here in the UK, I don't know why it's different. Somebody did explain it to me once, but I've forgotten. But here in the UK, it's Mother's Day today. And so I was talking to my mother, who is reading Heroes in Love at the moment, and there's a few quite steamy chapters in it. My mother's 97 and a wonderful supporter. And she said, I just got to chapter 5. Whoa, she said, you blew my head off there. But she loves it, and it's great. And for you know, whatever age, you can still learn more. You can still experience more. Why on earth not?
Now, do you think other than just the relationship being open in between the couple, do you think a plot line is any different in a gay crime novel?
Doesn't have to be, I guess. But in mine, I've always kept it as maybe this is why they are towards thrillers, I suppose, because I wanted to pick up on some kind of anti-gay conspiracy, which I still see, you know, a great deal in news reports of people who think, okay, we can find the gay gene and then we can make everybody straight again. Or why don't we just find some way of eliminating all the gays from the world? So I pick up on those kinds of conspiracy type plot lines. And maybe, I don't know yet, I've got a thousand and one ideas for other books that I want to write next, but the one I want to write after Foreign Affair, the third one in the Delingpole, is actually an historical based on this fascinating character in the 19th century in England, towards the end of the 19th century, which was after the Oscar Wilde trial, and with some very severe laws and anti-homosexuality laws were introduced. This man was actually living with his partner openly in a gay relationship in the north of England. And I thought there's a wonderful story to be told there, which is yet to be told. And many of the artistic community in England, including Ian Forster, for example, went to visit and stay with this couple. And there's a wonderful story which I've discovered, which I want to tell, which links into the First World War. So that will be more of a romance, and my first historical romance as well. But I would like after that to write a thriller, and in quite a different style, which would be interesting to do, which I don't think that the main plot line will be any kind of anti-gay one. It will just be a plot line which is a thriller. I use that word mainstream, but you and I know what that means.
Yes, exactly. Well, you did something new recently. You recorded The Necessary Deaths for an audiobook.
Yeah, absolutely.
What was that experience like?
Again, terrifying. I suppose I find every experience terrifying to start with. What happened was I thought it would be interesting to do The Necessary Deaths as an audiobook. And I went through the ACX route of putting up an audition script and hearing a number of auditions. And there were a couple that were really good. I mean, really very good. And I was listening to them with my boyfriend, who said, well, you used to speak on the radio. I used to read the news on BBC many years ago. He said, why don't you do it? It's your book after all. You know the characters better than anybody else. So I tried it, I'm talking to you from the dining room in our house at the moment. so it's slightly echoey. So I couldn't record a trial in there. So I ended up with the microphone under the duvet in my bedroom with a bunch of pillows and cushions stuffed around me, and read this, and it was quite hot at the time. The weather was hot, I mean. So it was altogether a very uncomfortable experience. Read this chapter, and it sounded not bad. And I sent it out to my beta readers anonymously, saying, I've got this voice which I'm thinking of using. What do you think? And they gave it the thumbs up. So I was then chatting to my neighbor, who works for the British Library in London, on an audio archives project. So I was picking his brains to get advice. At which point he said, well, you know, there's a studio 5 minutes walk from here, which I didn't know. So I popped along to the Black Frog Studios, as they're called, which they mainly record bands and musicians, but they do have a voice booth there where they do commercials. And I ended up using that. And I then thought, okay, I'll try another trial recording. And I sent it to a friend of my boyfriend's who's, she's a trained actress. And she said, I'll give you some coaching, which I desperately needed. She said, the main problem was I sounded like I was reading a book, whereas audiobooks are performed. Mm-hmm. You've got to, it's a whole different way of telling the story to just sitting there reading the book. So I went through weeks of preparation in the end, which was really good fun. And it meant I rediscovered the book all over again, which I hadn't read for a long time. And I'm quite a modest person normally, but when I was reading it, I thought, actually, this is quite good. The surprise was genuine when I read it. And I thought, oh, it's actually not bad. But one of the issues I had, or challenges I had, I suppose, is that there are quite a number of characters in it. And if I was to do lots of different accents, then I was going to come unstuck, because I've got a very, it's called a received pronunciation English accent, which is this fairly flat, ordinary English voice. But if I had a character come from Birmingham who's in the middle of England, they talk like that, you know. And I was wondering, could an American person listening to it actually understand that? I'm not sure if that was comprehensible or not for you, Brad.
It was.
Okay. Oh, okay. Not so bad.
And I'm terrible when it comes to accents, and I understood you just fine.
Okay, that's good. But then the people around here, they got a bit of a rural accent, you know, because they're from the country, and they talk like that. And again, I was kept worried, and I thought, well, I'm just going to have to do it in the end and see and what's to be lost. So that's what's happened. I've recorded it, and it's due out. Well, it's going through technical approval with Amazon at the moment. So as soon as it comes back from that, then I can start to schedule a publication date for it.
Do you have a guesstimate as to when you can expect it to release?
Within 6 weeks, I'd say.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll send out lots of notifications as soon as, obviously, to let everybody know, please go and listen to this book and see what you think. It took a lot of work, but it was interesting work. And it actually took me back to my radio days. I was a newsreader in my 20s, and it took me back to that. And I love radio. I think radio is wonderful. It's such a wonderfully intimate medium. It's just you and one person listening who you're talking to. And when I worked in the BBC and I moved from radio to television, I was horrified about the complexity of it in order to be able to get television onto the screen. There were so many people involved. Whereas when you work in radio, you can work on your own. It's just you, and it's a very intimate experience which you can create. So I got back to that, and it was a lovely experience. One of my favorite movies, actually, is A Prairie Home Companion, which was one of, I think it was the last film that Robert Altman made. And it's about this old-fashioned radio station where they do a variety show with lots of different kind of entertainment in it and loud live sound effects. Mm-hmm. It's got Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones and a wonderful cast in it. And it takes me back to the radio, which I used to adore. And I still love listening to podcasts and radio far more than watching television, I have to say.
I don't know if you know that. That was a real radio show.
Oh, it was Garrison Keillor, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
I used to love that show.
It's one of my comfort movies. You know, when it's a Sunday and it's pouring with rain and you can't go out, it's the movie that I put on. It's just so lovely to watch. It's so warm.
I've never seen the movie. I'll have to pull it out.
Oh, I was strong. And Garrison Keillor himself is in it as well. But it's got a really good cast.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here for awkward questions that authors get.
Uh-oh.
Oh, don't get too afraid. Everybody always gets nervous, and they're never so bad.
Take a slurp of water.
take a gulp. And, I'm going to spin the wheel here. So let me spin it. Okay. Yours isn't so bad. It's not a bad question in the sense, but it's one that sometimes is really difficult for us to answer. So the question you get today is, who do you base your characters after?
So I guess you get the same and other authors get the same, but people read the book and say, that's you, isn't it? And, or that's, oh no, that isn't me, is it, in the book? But there's lots of answers to that. Because when people read The Necessary Deaths, the first book, the main protagonist is called Dominic Dellingpole. My name is David Dawson. Again, it's DD, it's alliterative. Mm-hmm. And they said, it's you, isn't it? And my answer has always been, well, it's a bit of me. But actually, Jonathan McFadden, who is his partner, who is this loud, brash opera singer, who's afraid of nothing, is kind of aspirational me, I suppose. It's what I'd like to be, but I know I'm not. So I sit there quietly in the corner at parties, and I wish I was the one who was wearing a kilt and leaping up and dancing with everybody. And I think every character in the book has got a, well, it's got to be me because I wrote it in the end. But if I'm drawing on characterization, there's bits of everybody I've ever met in there. And I was told some years ago, which turned out to be really helpful, that when you're developing a character in a book, don't write down their Grindr profile in terms of how tall they are and what color eyes they are and so on. But what do they do? What motivates them? What makes them tick? And so I start with that, and I'm looking for a kind of character who's driven and ambitious and motivated. And then I do just start to think about people I've met who are like that. And then I draw on lots of little aspects of them. One of the genres I would have liked to write is fantasy, but I'm terrified of it because there you create completely new worlds, but completely new types of characters. And I don't know how I'd begin to do that. I would find that really, I really take my hat off to people who write fantasy. I really admire them, how they're able to do that.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by those that write fantasy or even sci-fi, just like you. To begin from scratch, from a blank sheet and create a world and a whole universe, it's impressive they can do that. It sounds like a lot of work to me.
Absolutely. I mean, so far, in all the books I've been writing, they're based on places I've been. All the locations are usually places I've been because I know I can write about them knowledgeably and confidently. And actually, at the towards the end of The Deadly Lies, there's a police chase, there's a car chase through San Francisco. And I used to live in Mountain View, south of San Francisco, some years ago. but it's a long time ago. So I actually plotted the car chase using Google Maps.
Mm-hmm. Thank God for Google Maps.
Absolutely right. And he's like, oh, there's a no left turn there. Right. Okay. So we couldn't go down that street. My ambition in the next book I write is to make it as imagined as possible, so that I do less of that. And it's just a mental exercise, I suppose, for me, because certainly in the latest book, Heroes in Love, one of the characters is a musician. He's a composer. Well, my boyfriend is a composer, musician, writes musicals. There are some aspects of him in there, obviously. And actually, when he was reading it, he kept saying, "How dare you? How dare you?" It was an homage. Let's say it's that.
Well, you know, as far as locations, my first book and the one I'm currently writing, both take place in Los Angeles, and I'm not originally from LA. I've lived here for 20 years, and there's not just a comfort in writing somewhere I'm from, but it's fun to share that with people. Mm.
Oh, absolutely right. Yes. I thought, I mean, that's, I'm based in the UK. I have readers across the world, which is so exciting. And you know, when you get emails from people in Spain or in Australia, it really touches me, actually. And I had a lovely email from a man the other day who's in his late 70s, and he lives, I think it's in Palm Springs, and his partner died 2 years ago, and they've been together for over 40 years. And Heroes in Love is partly about a relationship of a much older couple, which has lasted a long time. And he was telling me how much he was in tears when he was reading that. And I was just so touched that he took the time and trouble to write that. But the fact that I've been able to describe parts of London and parts of London life and ways of London life to this man who lived halfway across the world was very satisfying. And that is very enjoyable, that there's somewhere that you love, that you're very proud of, and you want the rest of the world to know about it as well. And I've got the privilege to be able to do that, which is just lovely.
Yeah, that's a great gift that you have. Well, I have one more question before I let you go. And how did you become involved with the Gay Men's Chorus?
Oh, well, there's a story. So I'll tell the full story, actually, because I came out when I was 51. So really quite recent in life. And as I said earlier, I've been married, have a son. My son's now 27 this year. My gosh, 27 this year. And when I come out, I had to tell my mother, who at the time was in her 80s. And she was kind of surprised to start with, because you're always told that your mother always knew, really, but she didn't ever say that, in fact. And then one day we were sat on the settee together, and she said, "Well, David, now that you're gay, I suppose you'll be joining that London Gay Men's Chorus." And I was really surprised, A, that she suggested it, and B, I'd never actually heard of the London Gay Men's Chorus at the time she suggested it. And she said, "Well, you know, you've always sung in choirs. You're very musical. You love singing in choirs." And she said, "You ought to continue doing that." And she said, "I saw them on the television the other night singing with Dolly Parton. And they seemed like lovely boys. So why didn't you join them?" And it's the honest truth. So I found a contact number for them. I rang them up. And that's how I came to join them. And actually, it's been wonderful. It really has been wonderful. I've been with them over 8 years now. And it's a lovely group of people. And we've got to perform in all sorts of places. Over 2 years ago now, we went on tour of New York and Chicago and got to sing in Central Park, got to sing with the New York City Gay Men's Chorus. Got to sing on Broadway, actually, Madame Tussauds, but all the same, it was on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And I was so fortunate to have been able to join them. But I told that story on stage in London at one of our concerts about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And the second part of the story is that, yes, I did have to tell my mother, but the first person I had to tell was my son. And I was really terrified of telling him. He just started at university. And I drove down to the university to see him, and plucking up courage, and I took him out for supper at a pizza restaurant, and I lost it. I couldn't do it. So I was then driving him back to the university thinking, I've got to tell him now. And I didn't in the car. And then we got out of the car, and I was walking him back to the university. And I said, look, Will, I've met someone. And it's a man. And he looked round at me and he said, you mean you're gay? And I still couldn't say it. And I said, sort of nodded. And then he said, well, do you love him? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, that's all right then. And it was as simple as that in the end. And it was just, and I was told that story on the stage. And that night, my son was in the audience. So when I got to the point, I heard the story from him afterwards, actually, that he said, you know, there you were singing. And he said, I was busting to go to the men's room. And so we just had the applause. So I was getting up to go to the men's room. I said, and then you walked down to the microphone. I thought, oh, no, I've got to stay here now and listen to Dad say something. So he stayed and then he heard that story. And so when it got to the point where I said, I have to tell my son first, he raised his hand and said, hey! And he got a massive round of applause in the concert hall. It was quite a magical moment.
Well, I'm glad you're not here because you would see the tears welling up in my eyes. That's a beautiful story. Absolutely beautiful. And that is a great way to end the show.
Thank you so much. It's lovely talking to you, Brad, as well. It really is. Thank you so much, Brad.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show, so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.